We'll believe in freedom cannot rest. You believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We'll believe in freedom,
we'll believe cannot, in freedom cannot rest.
Hear me talking to you. We'll believe in freedom.
We'll believe
cannot
in freedom
rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men, mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men. White mothers, sons, we who believe in freedom.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. K, sitting in for Mark Steiner here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that was, of course, Sweet Honey in the Rock, Ella's song, We Who Believe in Freedom Cannot Rest. Today we're talking about 2015 and the state of black America. Call us at 410-319-8888, tweet us at Mark Steiner or at K Whitehead, or visit us on our Facebook page. We want to hear from you. Last year was a tumultuous year in black America. Income, education, and equality gaps have remained steady. Communities were challenged, lives were disrupted, and business thankfully did not proceed as usual. Additionally, the killings of unarmed black men and women by police and would-be police officer, and later the lack of indictments in those killings, continued to spark massive protests, further illuminating the trust gap between many communities of color and law enforcement. The Black Lives Matter movement moved into its third year, unofficially if you mark the beginning with the murder of Trayvon Martin, and was joined by the Say Her Name movement, a push to include what was happening to black women and girls into the lexicon. So what does it mean to live and breathe while black in America? What were some of the successes and failures with the movement? What issues still need to be addressed, and where do we go from here? We have an amazing panel joining me to talk about these issues and more. On the phone, we have Dr. Bettina Love, associate professor at the University of Georgia and a 2016 Harvard Fellow. Good morning, Dr. Love.
Good morning.
So glad you could join us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you. And we also have Dr. Treva Lindsay, assistant professor of women's, gender, and sexuality studies at The Ohio State University. Good morning, Dr. Lindsay.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. So glad to have you back. In the studio, we finally have Dr. Katrina McDonald, who's an associate professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University and board member of the Center for Africana Studies. Welcome.
Thank you.
And finally, we have Lady Breon. She's a spoken word artist and Baltimore's Grand Slam champion. She's a resident poet for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle and the program manager for Do More Baltimore. Good morning, Lady Breon.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Dr. Lindsay, let's start with you. At the start of 2015, the National Urban League noted that America today is a tale of two nations. It is a tale of two Americas. How did we see this play out in 2015?
I think we saw it play out in a number of ways. I mean, I think as you introduced this segment, I really thought about what Black Lives Matter meant in 2015 and how we ended 2015, particularly with the non-indictments in both the very suspicious death of Sandra Bland and also in the non-indictment of Officer Timothy Lohman in the murder of Tamir Rice. And I think a lot of us felt extremely unsettled going into 2016, knowing that this had happened. I think part of this is also understanding at the end of the year, we looked at still 64,000 black women missing in the U.S., black women's unemployment at about 10.6%. We're one of the few groups, and one of the only group actually, that has stagnated around unemployment. And these issues, I feel, as we see on social media, as we see in the media, just play out in such different ways depending on who you're talking to. A lot of this divides along racial lines, some of this along class lines, unfortunately also around gender lines. When we see the Oregon militia take over, which many of us framed as domestic terrorism, and then thinking about when an unarmed 12-year-old is in a park and seen as a deadly threat. There are clearly two Americas in terms of how people are policed, how people perceive policing, and then even how media picks up these different issues, whether we're talking about the language of riots versus unrest or uprising, if we're talking about looting versus people really responding to the non-response of the state to the constant violation of black life, two Americas in terms of thinking about gun violence, two Americas in terms of thinking about anti-immigration, with ICE raids happening all over the country right now. So I think that there are these really brewing tensions that are showing us that the 21st century will very much so be defined by how we reconcile and reckon with the fact that our state is predicated upon there being two nations, the haves and the have-nots, the disenfranchised, and the very small few that have the power to maintain this kind of really rigid hierarchy. And in turn, these very racist logics.
Well, with laying that out for us, Dr. Love, I want to pull you into it. There are some who believe that America is less post-racial now than it was before President Obama was elected. In 2015, did that happen? I mean, are we becoming more divided? And if so, were we ever actually post-racial?
So just to simply say no. We were never post-racial. I don't think there's even begin that conversation would be to say that we were reaching that point at some way. But I also think to kind of piggyback on Dr. Lindsay about these issues that we're facing, I come out of the School of Education, and we also see kids, particularly African-American kids, being tested more than ever. From the city of Atlanta, we saw 12 teachers go to jail, right? So we now have like a teacher-to-prison pipeline. And so when we think about post-racial, when we look at statistics that talk about the quality of life of Americans, you see people of color, right, at the bottom of all of these statistics. And so how do we reckon with that? But we also have to think about America's moral compass. How do we change America's moral compass? How do we get people to look at the killings of black people that you can now watch 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in your hand? And we still cannot get legislation. We still cannot get people have a national conversation about these things. And so to think about this idea of post-racial in terms of all the killings and the people who went to jail in 2015 is a joke, but it also speaks to white America's moral compass and where they are sitting right now and how comfortable they are right now as we are dying in the streets.
Dr. McDonald, as a sociologist, can you just help us very quickly contextualize what it means to talk about two different lived experiences? I mean, is that really too narrow? Because we're not really talking about being Hispanic or being brown in America or what it means to be Asian. We keep focusing only on like to be black or to be white. Can you kind of help us frame that a bit?
Well, it is very true that we continue to speak in a black-white language, even as people have protested it fiercely over the years. The reason, I believe, is because the issues often are so black and white themselves, that there is and there isn't, there are and there aren't, and that puts us in the framework of thinking black-white, and it spills over to everything else. At the same time, it's also due to the reality that every time you turn around and look at the worst of what's happening in our country, it's being affected on black people and not on white people, or to a much less degree. Of course, nothing is purely black and white, we know. We know there are plenty of shades of gray in between and so forth. But people still feel as though if you're in a particular category, you're going to get fed better or worse things. And so that language continues. I think that in terms of post-racial, for instance, and thinking of the world being different, people really need to think about whether they really believe in that and whether they really want it. Because to be in a post-racial world means what? We can't just talk about it. We have to think about what does it mean? In my daily, how will things be different for me daily if we are no longer racist? I think we're a long way off from that. But I think we ought to really think about what do we mean by that and do we really want to go there?
Lady Breon, let me pull you into this. And what does this mean for Baltimore City? Are there really two experiences? We know so many of these questions have an obvious answer. But it seems like from the national conversation, people still need to be taught again that they're two different realities. How does this play out in Baltimore City?
I mean, yes, no question. The idea of there being a black Baltimore is no secret, right? I think one thing that was interesting after the uprising, I was reading an article where someone was questioning about the fact that they couldn't tell where the uprising had actually occurred because all of the cities they were riding through, they were looking at all of these boarded up buildings, all of these, all this dilapidation. It's like, I can't even tell where the uprising even took place, right? And that's a reality for people who exist in this black Baltimore that the other parts of Baltimore have no knowledge of or don't care to talk about, right? We look at, kind of this big boiling point that happened in Baltimore as this one moment when really there's this whole genealogy that led up to that moment, right? All of these different types of injustices that people deal with in black Baltimore all the time, and it's not a secret, but everybody else can easily ignore because that's what privilege provides to you. So, right, this idea of a split, particularly in our city and in major cities across the nation, it's just a reality, and it's something that we have to talk about, and we can't continue to ignore, right, or you're going to continue to have this kind of unrest until people get what they need to survive. It's just simple survival.
For Treva, this idea of we're talking Black Baltimore versus, I don't know, a white Baltimore or other Baltimore. I mean, we see the same thing in Ohio, and we're steadily having conversations. Is conversation enough?
I mean, I never want to halt conversation because I do think conversation is an important piece of the puzzle. But here we say the piece of the puzzle, because there's so much that we have to address that requires a certain kind of action, requires a certain kind of advocacy, a certain kind of direct action. I'm open to any and all strategies. I recently posted that I'd become frustrated with signing petitions and demanding federal investigations into certain incidents and practices, because some of this is coming down to the core of the system itself is not broken. It's working exactly how it's supposed to work. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of reform is so hard to swallow, because if we think about our nation as foundationally built upon the policing, containment, and violation of Black and Indigenous bodies, where do we go from that? Right? Imagining policing as a way to monitor fugitive slaves. Right, fugitive enslaved people. To think about that as the legacy, to think about the robustness of our prison industrial complex and not think about that in this longer history of containment of people of color, of people who fall outside the margins. If we're also talking about trans bodies who were violated in 2015 as well. And so I think in this instance, what we need is really the conversation needs to shift to beyond reform, which I think is also a lot of where people who were engaged in so much of the activism over the last 3 years, if we think about Black Lives Matter, starting since 2012 when there was a push for good body cameras. Well, what happens when you have a 12-year-old being shot on camera in 2 seconds and there's a non-indictment? That doesn't give me faith that the system itself is working. We have a number of things on videos these days, and that still has not produce the kinds of outcomes we have expected. In fact, I think the spectacle of Black death has almost become entertainment.
Oh, well, that's what Bettina was talking about. I mean, Bettina,
absolutely.
Didn't you mention about this idea that we can hold these images, not just in our hand, because I know you did this whole book where you looked at Little Sister speaking up in terms of hip hop, but aren't we holding them in our mind, in our spirits, in our bodies as well?
Well, I mean, I think there's also this idea of spirit murdering, right? So just because you don't physically kill me, doesn't mean you're not murdering my spirit every day. Mm. And I think that's what we have to also be engaging with. And I think that is, for me, why Black Lives Matter is such a powerful movement, because they're also very concerned with healing. They're also very concerned with self-care. And I think where we are right now, that is a very crucial moment, because, you know, we may not be the ones being pulled over, but we know we can be pulled over at any time.
Right.
And dealing with that every single day. So we have the physical death, and then we also have this murdering of our spirits and our ideas and our concepts of life. And I think that's very important that we also begin to have the conversations and engage in the healing work of that as well, because trauma and death is all around us.
Now, Kat, with this notion that Bettina just mentioned, this notion of trauma and death being all around us and our young people constantly being exposed to images of people that look like them, being shot and killed and left in the street to bleed to death. Like, so what do we do as a community to kind of get our young people, that's who I'm most concerned with, through this kind of traumatic experience? I mean, maybe this second middle passage, in a sense, of just our bodies being used and trampled on at all times.
I think that we have to educate young people about themselves and about us as a community and our history, to grind into them their importance. You know, just to really bolster them against all the negativity that's around them. There are plenty of agencies and organizations that try to do that, or even individuals, you know, who work really hard to help young people understand that they're not what the world portrays them to be, that they really are important. They give a lot of time to history, for instance, you know, to help them understand where they came from. But it isn't an easy solution when all around you, as you're trying to teach those lessons, they're dying. You know, they're literally dying. In my experience of late, over the last couple of years, I've tried to work with my students in helping them to understand that their voices matter, that they do have the ability to communicate with the rest of the world. They don't just have to talk to each other, but they can put words together to protest in a way that people will listen. And I think that the march that we had after what had just happened, this is right after the gentleman died here in Baltimore.
Freddie Gray.
Okay.
So
yeah. The big march we had that went down St. Paul Street,
that
down
would
to
start,
City Hall.
I remember that march. It started in his
Hopkins.
Community.
It started
and
at
were,
Hopkins.
Yeah. So there were like four different marches, though.
Yeah, but see, the kids started that movement at Hopkins. You know, my Black Student Union at Hopkins and some other surrounding students and different BSUs and so forth. They came up with that. And we started off with like 200 people. By the time we got down to City Hall, we had 6,000. Mm-hmm. And that empowered those young people. They got to see each other out on the street, working for each other and working for their city. I thought it was a tremendous day. It was overwhelmingly tremendous. And I'm not saying that all of our activities have to be of that magnitude and have to be loud and stuff. But I think we have to show the students that you can speak out and you can put your words together that people will listen. Not everybody, obviously. But you have to keep that up. The fear that people have, of course, is that we get a really good thing going, and then we don't hear anything for several weeks or months. You know, we got to keep the pressure on. So I'm trying to help the students keep up their stamina.
Well, with Lady Brianna, because you're here in Baltimore City, I know you work a lot with Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle in terms of getting young people involved. What are some things that you did in 2015 to keep young people interested, involved, engaged?
I mean, the truth of the matter is it wasn't a lot of work we had to do to get young people involved. Mm-hmm. Young people were taking the charge and taking the initiative. She talks about that, you know, huge march that happened that ended at City Hall, right? That was a bunch of college students who got together and decided to mobilize on their campuses and then conjoin at Penn Station and then, you know, do that march down St. Paul. I was a part of that. You know, I knew some of the lead organizers who were from Towson University, right? I think about all the young high school students who were also doing their own demonstrations. I think about City Block at City High School, right, where Michaela Gilliam Price was a part of mobilizing young people there and all around the city, right? It wasn't Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, or in my opinion, any other grassroots organization that had to get young people charged up. They were ready to go from the beginning. And in places or instances where, you know, there were adults who were complacent or who were too afraid to go out in the streets or who were, you know, wary about impending violence or whatever, you had young people who were just so tired that they felt like they had to do something. They had to say something. They were energized all on their own. And I don't think it would be wise for me or anybody else to take credit from the young people because it was all them.
That's true.
Well, Treva, then how do we keep that going? So if the young people were in the forefront, and we talk about these big marches coming after the death of Freddie Gray in this city, the murder of Freddie Gray, let's be very clear, how do we keep them involved? And how do we also do some transgenerational work? Because I think we need people along the spectrum, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think those conversations I think are really happening. I mean, I know people have so many critiques of movements, and it's so new. It's so nascent in certain ways. And seeing students and people I've never seen at marches, come out to events and things, being galvanized, being radicalized around these things, I think we're still in a space of, like, the energy being countered on and really allowing these young people who are really focused in many ways, I think, on creating a leaderful movement, right? Their ideas about leadership and movement and what's necessary. I mean, there are no limits to it in certain ways because they haven't been jaded by organizational bureaucracy.
True.
Yeah, they haven't been jaded in the same ways that we have by all of the losses we incur in this long war that this is, right? This is some fresh blood being drawn into this. And so I think to really have that transgenerational kind of dialogue, and so that is somewhere where I still think we need a number of conversations still to happen, to think about strategy, to think about what is it that these young people are saying they want to see in the world? What is the vision that they have? Even between me and my students, I often see some interesting differences in terms of what they see, what they want, and what they desire. So there's an active and radical practice of listening and an ethics of generosity between generations that we need to embrace as we move forward, because they're killing us as babies and they're killing us as older folks, right? I mean, the range of the ways in which we're being violated really span that. And so I think really foregrounding the different ways that we're experiencing this, have experienced this, and listening to each other to form a multidimensional and multi-platform approach to injustice, black racial injustice, I think is so integral to moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get some callers in here. Nathaniel from West Baltimore, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Hello to everyone. we've been protesting and marching since the turn of the century. And how far has it gotten us? Really nowhere. I mean, this city has been like this. I'm 50. This city has been like this since I can remember. I mean, there's been no real, you know, revitalization. There's been projects or talked about projects. There's plenty of gentrification. And now they're going to do some re-gentrification down here in Sandtown. But short of a serious revolution, that's the only thing that's going to change this. I mean, this is about money. It's about blacks against whites, but it's really about money. For some reason, we don't want to come together. That's our most powerful weapon is our dollar. You know, that's the only thing that really pushed anything in Selma was the bus boycott, when they said, oh, man, these black folks are not riding our buses. We're losing money. You know, we got to do something. So short of all our revolution is the only thing I think will change, or if we come together and realize that our money, our strength is in our money.
Thank you so much, Nathaniel. Thank you. So let's get to that before we go to break. Bettina, he's saying that marching is not working. Let's get some feedback on that. He's saying the only thing we can do is do kind of these economic boycotts. What do you think?
I mean, I never want to say that it's an or. It's an and. And I think we have to be very careful to understand that when we take two steps, white supremacy takes four.
Mm.
Right? So we didn't ask to come here, and we didn't create the cards that we were dealt. So I think we always have to understand that when we do organize, and I think we sometimes talk as if we haven't made any progress, and we have, but we have to understand that white supremacy is also making progress as well. We sometimes forget about the pushback that is going to come, and we have to be ready for the pushback. And that is why I think Black Lives Matter is different than anything we've ever seen. Because Black Lives Matter, yes, we're asking for laws and legislation, and we're asking for governance, but we're also asking this radical idea to matter.
So, Kat, what do you...
That's a long project.
So let me ask Kat to get in here right before we go to break. If you could just quickly kind of pull that together. So we have, it's not an either or, it's an and, really. So what else do you think we should be doing?
First of all, I totally agree with you on the both and point. In the history of African-American struggle, we've seen all kinds of activities happening at once. It took everything. It took a Malcolm X and a Martin Luther King, you know, and a Rosa Parks. It took all those people to accomplish what we did. And I think that what we need to learn today is that we still have to work in multiple camps at once. I think one of the things that students have learned from all of this, for instance, is that you can complain all day and pronounce all the problems all day, but you've got to throw solutions out there, clear, mm-hmm. concrete solutions. So my students very surprisingly confronted the president recently, along with many other colleges in the country, where students confronted their presidents and said, hey, we got to have change. Well, Hopkins did it, believe it or not.
And it's happening at Loyola as
And
well.
It's happening as Loyola
yes.
as well. And they called him out. And they were eloquent. I was never more proud of them. They brought out all the black alumni. And what was interesting about that is that black alumni who came to that forum were the blacks who hired me.
Oh, wow.
So. They were the students who, again, 23 years ago or so, were fighting the same fight that today's students are, you know. So, but they got to be in the same room, which hits your point about the intergenerational cooperation. So what I saw come out of that is that the kids of today got to meet with these very professional blacks of the past who still had fire in their bellies.
I like that.
And that was really powerful. So I do think that we're at a point where we do have to come together with concrete solutions.
Well, we're going to talk about that. Stay with us after the break as we continue to address these topics, come up with some concrete solutions, and talk about successes and failures of the movement. We have Drs. Bettina Love, Treva Lindsay, Katrina McDonald, and Lady Brianna is with us. Join us at 410-319-8888. On the way to break with Sweet Honey and the Rock, I want to remind you to join Mark Steiner at 7 a.m. on Wednesday, January the 13th, for the 13th Annual Annapolis Summit at the Governor Calvert House on the opening day of the state legislature in Annapolis. Joining discussions, we talk to Governor Larry Hogan, Senator President Mike Miller, House Speaker Michael Bush, and U.S. Senator Barbara Mikulski is going to join us for a special interview. Save your seat and get more information about sponsorships at thedailyrecord.com/Annapolis-summit or by contacting Morgan Cook at 443-524-8181 or morgan.cook@thedailyrecord.com. The Annapolis Summit is sponsored by The Daily Record, the Maryland State Education Association, Stevenson University, Alexander and Cleaver VPC, the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, and WEAA. We'll be right back.
Bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck.
Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. This is Dr. K on Thursday, sitting in for the great man himself. We're going to continue our conversation about 2015, exploring what it meant to live and breathe while Black in America. Join us at 410-319-8888. We're here with Dr. Bettina Love. She's a 2016 Harvard Fellow. We have Dr. Treva Lindsay from The Ohio State University, Dr. Katrina McDonald from Johns Hopkins, and Lady Brianna, who is a spoken word artist and a resident poet. In this second half of the show, we're just going to open it up for everyone to join in. We're going to throw out topics, and we're going to ask all of our panelists to just kind of jump in and out of the conversation so we can talk about and wrestle with some of these issues. Things like, you know, these multiple battles to keep our children alive, our ways to keep them healthy. How do we provide decent housing for people of color in marginalized communities? Healthy food options, mental health services, safe and clean environments, and decent, though I would prefer, stellar educational opportunities. These are battles that we fought in 2015, and some people say that we did not win. So, Lady Brianna, let's start with you and then open it up. What do you think? Are we still losing these battles? Are we winning? Are we gaining ground?
I think that there are always a multitude of issues that we're fighting against, right, all the time. And I think that people have to focus on whatever is their specific battle for them and go after that, because trying to go after everything is overwhelming. You always feel like you're losing and getting beat down, right? Yeah. So I think about Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and for us right now, we're looking for reform to LEOBR, right, the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, because we see what unfolded in Baltimore largely could have been different with the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, particularly, you know, the idea behind only sworn police officers can investigate instances of police misconduct, right? Or the fact that they get 10 days before they have to give a statement of any kind, right? And in instances like this, that allows them to kind of create their own story, get all the evidence, and then produce what they're going to tell the public, right? Or the idea that on the review board itself, there can be no non-law enforcement officers. And so for us, that's all we're going to focus on in 2016.
So that's your big issue.
That's
dealing
our big
police
issue.
Policing themselves.
Police policing themselves, because it's ridiculous.
Right.
Right? That's like I murder somebody and only my homeboys get to decide what's going to happen to me, right? And so ultimately, you know, it's this old boys club, this kind of gang mentality. And for us, for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle here in Baltimore, that's our hot topic. And so I encourage people who are organizing, who are mobilizing, who are trying to make change, pick something and go full force for that.
One issue.
Exactly. Because when you decide everything's wrong and I have to change the world, the reality is you're not going to change anything.
Because
you do one issue.
You gotta choose issue. Something and go for it, mm-hmm. right? And, okay. and I mean, I know it sounds like small, but the reality is that's how change starts.
What's change right. starts small? Treva, Bettina, mm-hmm. Kat, what do you think?
Well, I think she's absolutely right that everybody's got to pick something, but you've also got to keep your ears, you know, pinned to the other issue so mm-hmm. you can feel it moving forward. The issues that I've chosen to focus on in recent years have been the black infant mortality issue, mm-hmm. which is now riding the coattails of the Black Lives Matter by talking about Black Babies Matter. And also K-12 education is a big area of mine. And the black infant mortality issue, most people don't know that the discrepancy between white and black babies living beyond the age of one has risen, not decreased over time. And the National Institutes of Health have poured tons of money into this for years, and we're not really much closer to where we were then in solving the problem. So there are some.
So we're throwing money at it, but we're not seeing real gains.
We're not seeing, yeah. And so a number of people that I know, black women in particular around the country, are working on new projects to get the word out, you know, that this is still a huge problem and it's unfair to allow these babies to die because they are not receiving the kinds of resources that white babies do in some cases. And the other project that I've been really fascinated about for years is the urban boarding schools project.
Oh, okay. Oh.
There are a few of them around the country, but the idea is when schools are failing and families are suffering, there can be, as we know, families who suffer from drug addiction and alcoholism and other kinds of social ills, and the children suffer. And so they have conceptualized a boarding school where you don't go to Connecticut, right? You stay in Baltimore. You don't go overseas. You stay in Baltimore 5 days a week, and then you go home on the weekends. And during those 5 days, the children go to school together. They learn to live together. Most importantly, they learn to respect each other and rely on each other in ways that I think we as a black population have sort of lost because of our being scattered about the nation. And so I'm really interested in perhaps making inroads with these two projects and having them kind of spill over.
So the same thing that Lady Brianna is saying, let's narrow your focus. Everybody can't
definitely
do everything. Treva, Bettina, what do you think?
I think for me, I totally agree. You know, I think the mountain is big, and we're not going to be able just to push the mountain by ourselves. Everybody has to do their part. And for me, my biggest issue is taking these issues and bringing them into classrooms.
Okay.
In everyday classrooms, you know, it doesn't have to be some type of elite school that is having these conversations. You know, when things were happening in Ferguson, students were told to be quiet. Teachers were told they couldn't speak about these things. And you're silencing our kids in the classroom. They see what's going on. And for many teachers are scared to have these conversations, but these are the conversations not only that need to happen in school, but these are the conversations that get our kids going.
Definitely.
And get them interested in education and get them involved in civic education. And so for me, you know, my biggest goal is trying to move these conversations inside of K-12 classrooms.
Okay.
With teachers and students to get students to become civically minded. Think about civic journalism, thinking about how they're using activism every day in their daily lives and what that means, and trying to rewrite our ideas of civic education. Because if you look at Black Lives Matter, that is civic education.
Right.
And so trying to parallel those things for teachers and educators to understand that what kids are doing in the streets should be acknowledged and affirmed in classrooms.
Now, Treva, for you, as you talk about your issue, I know one of the things that I noticed on your Facebook page and on Twitter is that you work a lot with the kind of Say Her Name campaign, which people are still not very familiar with. So, you know, as you talk about your issue, can you talk also a little bit about that for people?
Sure. So I think part of this for Say Her Name, a lot of what I've seen my role in this, and I think we all have a role, so I echo everyone. Everyone's sentiments, and I'm so excited to hear this kind of work is happening and that people are so invested in it, is really to bring a lot of issues to the forefront, to be in the classroom like Dr. Love, my colleague, and bring this to my students, but also advising different entities who are doing different kinds of work. I, as a historian, am trained in certain ways and know a little bit about a lot of different things. And some of this is like, here's some information about food deserts. Let's go hard on it. Like, here's some information I can give you so we can think about this contextually and how this connects to Black Lives Matter, and in particularly how this impacts Black women and girls. Let's think about incarceration and how that impacts certain communities disproportionately and what that means. And so I often see myself as an educator in different spaces, in conversation with community, and really helping folks to see these connections between all of these things. And I really enjoy that kind of work of making those connections, building bridges, putting people doing different kinds of work in the same room to see how this all fits into a broader vision of justice. And part of that advocacy for me has really been highlighting the ways in which Black women and girls, transgender nonconforming, and gender nonbinary folks are impacted by a lot of these injustice issues in very particular and distinct ways. And so with Say Her Name, which was initiated by Kimberly Crenshaw and the African American Forum Policy Institute, to really bring to bear what we're seeing, that we put Sandra Bland in context, that we have the assault at Spring Valley High in a context, that we have the Jerrica in a context, that we see these things as connected to narratives of anti-Black racial violence, but we don't forget the ways in which these violences can often be gender-specific, especially in a case like Daniel Holdsclaw and the rape of 13 Black women in Oklahoma City. That we really begin to look at suspension rates and disciplinary rapes in schools that disproportionately impact Black girls and women. So I think that having Say Her Name forces us within the movement to do some internal reflection and do that kind of work. And the last point I just wanted to make is I also want to be encouraged by some of the victories we did have last year if we think about the movement. I think we're always, you know, bombarded by the fact that so much is unchanging. But let's look at these minor these things, like California now saying they're going to have only, you know, judges as opposed to grand juries in the context of deciding these kind of indictments against police. The release of several thousand nonviolent offenders from federal prisons, even though we are skeptical of what this will mean, but the increase of body cameras. If we think about more people being invested and being involved in these movements, and getting involved in coming to organizational things, I think this is also kind of important. And you have more critical conversations about what prison reform and even prison abolition looks like than you had 1 year ago. So I think that those are important markers of the fact that we just have to continue pushing. And the last one being economic, to echo the caller from before, you know, Black Friday and the holidays took a hit. Right. Because of Black Lives Matter. Let's be clear about that. People will tell you otherwise, but numbers don't lie. And there's some real numbers that came out about the holiday shopping and holiday thing, that us saying where we're going to spend our money and where we're not going to spend our money does have an impact as well. So thinking about, again, these multi-platform ways of approaching justice.
I absolutely agree with you. I even think the idea that Black Lives Matter is now a part of the lexicon of America in terms of discussions, that is a success. I mean, it's happening from K-12 to my grandmother. People are talking about Black Lives Matter. We have a ton of callers on the phone, and I want to give them each just a quick moment to give their comment or question, and then we'll look at them. We'll go first to Charlie from Baltimore. Good morning, Charlie.
Yeah, are you there?
I am here. Thank you. What is your comment?
Okay. First of all, it's a pleasure for me to get through. I've been trying to get through for a while, and this is a good time to share on this because this is a topic that I discuss with people on a regular, everyday basis. When it comes to Black Lives Matter, and I'm not trying to pull a race card, but a lot of people might get upset about the fact that I'm saying this, and I am Black. But I feel as though, like, sometimes Black people can be just a little selfish, to where as though, like, we know that the odds are always better against us. We know good and well that, you know, we're out here in society where the system is designed for us to fail. Whether or not we're out here doing right or wrong, you know, you're automatically criticized for standing on the street corner if you're out there late at night. You could be waiting on a bus or you could be waiting on a ride, but you're automatically assumed to be targeted as a drug dealer just because you fit the description of suspicion. But we're always categorized and put into these different type of categories to where as though, like, if something bad happens to us, the odds are always bet against us, and we're more than likely not going to win.
Okay, thank you so much, Charlie. I want to get to Freddie, who also has a comment. Good morning, Freddie. Thank you for holding.
To your listeners and to the radio show, I'm sitting here listening to the program and everything. My comment is that if you could take and look at the community, if we could stop killing ourselves, that's where it stopped. Black lives doesn't matter. You know, we could do all the demonstrations and all the protesting that you want until we look at ourselves in our communities, how many murders it is in Baltimore City alone this year. And you tell me and asking Black Lives Matter. Because Black Lives doesn't matter if we all kill ourselves. Secondly, all the things we gotta do, look at all these little liquor stores and Chinese nail shops, Chinese carryouts and all that, like the brother had it right before. The economy dollar count. the dollar count. If we stop spending that money at these little so-called liquor stores in our community, which is feeding us something to keep us high, drunk, out of our minds, so that we do continue doing these things. Until then, that would never be. You could go on and on and on about the things that you could come up with ideas of how to think that Black lives matter. Until then, you could never get nothing done.
Okay, thank you so much, Freddie. I think these are excellent points, and I think I want to have the panel wrestle with this, because both Freddie and Charlie kind of raised the question that people often talk about. Do Black lives matter to Black people? Which I think is a very interesting question. And Kat, I want to throw to you first.
Sure. I can certainly sympathize, sir, with the way that you are thinking about these problems, and they are real. But we have to take the long view of history when we look at this. We have to understand the roots of why the deaths are happening in our community. And I think that it's going to require us to take each piece of the problem. There are problems with, you know, Blacks learning to distrust each other, killing each other, not patronizing one another in our stores and things like that. We need to take each of those pieces and find a way to re-communicate with one another about why you matter to me. Because what you're talking about is one Black person mattering to another. And I don't think we've engaged in enough talk about what it means for us to be in concert on these things. So part of our resolution has to be to get people together to discuss what do we mean to one another across the board.
Bettina and Treva and Lady Breon, I mean, this whole notion of do Black lives matter to Black people, it's almost offensive sometimes when I hear that as the excuse for why we should not be engaging and fighting against this oppressive system. Like, what have you found out there?
I mean, for me, it's always an interesting conversation because to me, the two are not connected in any way. When we're talking about police violence, police misconduct, police brutalization and militarization of our communities, right? That is not connected to one Black person killing another Black person, right? Because, you know, violence within communities happen in all communities. It is not something that is unique to the Black community, right? We just don't have terms for white on white violence or Hispanic on Hispanic violence, right? We just don't say that, but that happens as well, right? The difference is if a Black person kills another Black person, they will be held accountable. They will, you know, probably go to prison or whatever. But the reality is when there is state violence, the same does not happen. No one is held accountable. It happens over and over again, and nothing is happening. So that's why you see this outpouring, these cries, rallying cries, you know, because people are tired of there being no recourse for what is happening, right? And in our communities, yes, we do have to do the work of loving ourselves more. But that is also because of white supremacy in this state and people learning to hate themselves, people learning not to love their community, right? There is a lack of resources in communities that cause people to go out and feel like they have to steal and kill and sell drugs and do et cetera, right? So there is this long string of things that lead to Black-on-Black violence that we have to talk about. We can't just say, stop the killing as if that is the answer, because it's not.
And Treva and Bettina, I mean, I think it's an easy answer. Oh, you need to only focus on your own community. Only you need to look at within. Oh, you need to stop the killings, as if that's going to help us in this system of oppression that is rallied against us. So what have you found, Treva and Bettina? Are people kind of throwing that up as the same old excuse for why we should not be doing what we're doing?
Well, I think it's very interesting how we critique the media for messages, but we don't critique the media for its monolithic message of Black Lives Matter.
Right.
And I think that's a very interesting point. So the fact is, Black Lives Matter has always been talking about loving Black folks and how do we make our community safer? How do we talk about jobs? How do we talk about, the prison industrial complex? How do we talk about education? That has always been a part of Black Lives Matter, but the media doesn't show that. And so people who are not familiar with the movement or in the movement, they only know what the media says about Black Lives Matter. They see Black Lives Matter only as a monolithic movement that comes out when a white police officer kills a Black kid or a Black person. And then that for them becomes Black Lives Matter. And so when you do some research or just truly just go on the website, you will see that this is not a monolithic organization or a movement or a mantra. And so it's very interesting how we critique the media at one point, but we don't critique it for how it demonstrates our movements and our voice.
And Treva, folks act like Black Lives Matter is new. Maybe the term Black Lives Matter is new, But this focus on trying to make our communities better and stronger and healthier, that is not new for
us.
Not
at all. In fact, we're going to be visited in a couple months by Angela Davis.
Oh, here at Johns Hopkins?
Here at Hopkins. And it reminds me, as I go through the process of receiving her, of just how this is so reminiscent of the 60s.
It's the same thing.
The Black Panther Party was combating the same things. Angela Davis was writing about the same things we're debating now, particularly around the prison industrial complex, around poor nutritional issues for fam, all kinds of things. We're just revisiting this, which means there's been a problem with truly moving things forward. So I think we're at a moment in our history where we need to say enough. We're going to move it forward. We're not going to revisit this in 20 years. In 20 years, we're going to deal with something else. But we got to get rid of this old stuff we've been carrying for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And Treva, you were going to say something. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I think, one, the notion that we don't care about ourselves is just, it seems very harmful for me that we're believing that.
Exactly.
I just think that's a really harmful message. And that doesn't mean that there aren't issues that are interracially experienced that absolutely are connected to the fact that there's so much systemic violence and so many things. As my other panelists mentioned, what the state has done that has also helped to produce the context in which we see these rampant rates of violence within communities. But we can't address that if we're not addressing education, employment, health, food security. Mm-hmm. All of these things impact the ways in which we experience this. But also, y'all don't march when there's violence in the community. Yes, we do. You're just not watching. You're not paying attention. We are taking care of ourselves. We are taking care of extended family. We form kinship networks to care for one another when these things are happening, with the diseases of addiction that are treated like criminal problems as opposed to public health issues are dealt with. We've always been dealing with that internally. That is something I think a lot of these younger organizations today really inherited from some of the movement in the 60s and 70s, whether we're talking about the 10-point program and the work of the Black Panthers, we're talking about books and breakfasts that are happening all over the country right now to make sure our communities are fed and fed well. That's happening right now. You have the Interrupters in Chicago that are on corners ensuring that violence is diffused and talking through these things with people. You have war vets who are on the corners in Chicago doing similar work. You have the moms of people in Chicago doing that work and trying to prevent. And they have communities that have had a significant decrease in violence because of the presence of this. So to say we're not showing up is harmful and also inaccurate, but it also feeds into the idea that somehow, let's say, gang members, and I put that in strong quotations, are killing each other, that we're giving police the same kind of space and morality and ethical compass that you're saying gang members have, right? That police should have the same freedom to kill Black people? Like, that's an absurd statement to me. I'm sorry to feel so passionate about it, but I think
the
internalization of that, to me, is an internalization of white supremacist logic about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. That must be confronted.
We can't ask for the state to do better if we have issues in our community versus we can ask for the state to not only do better, but to really get itself together completely around Black life, and we continue to value Black life and push each other to love each other better. Because it's hard to love in these times. That's the other thing. It's hard to love when you see so much violence and trauma around you. It is really hard to wake up and love yourself and love others that look like you when so many messages are telling you otherwise.
And it's also offensive to think that as people, we cannot focus on more than one issue at a time. So you can only deal with the homicide, right? Or you can only deal with Sandra Bland, or you can only deal with Tamir Rice, rather than the fact that just like we're multicultural and multidiverse, we can also think on many different levels. And all of these are issues. Going back to what you said, Lady Breon, everyone doesn't have to push the same boulder up the hill.
Exactly.
We have enough people who can pick up and do the work.
Exactly.
So how does that play out in Baltimore City then?
What is that?
You were saying that the Leaders of the Beautiful Struggle, that you have this one issue that you're working with.
Right.
That the thing that you're going to focus on. Well, what else is happening?
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's interesting because even though I said that is what we're doing legislatively, but, you know, we're also doing coat drives and food drives.
There you go.
And partnering with other organizations who are doing, you know, whatever work that they're doing in separate communities. It's like we can love the community and try to change the community
and
at the same time.
Exactly. Yes.
Like, they're not mutually exclusive. And the idea is that, you know, I like what other panelists were talking about. when we talk about the Black Lives Matter movement, right, it's not just about teaching the rest of the country that Black Lives Matter. It's also reifying the notion to ourselves that we matter. So that means whatever we have to do to better the material conditions of our people, that is what we do. And if you don't have the capacity to do it within your own circle, you connect with people who do. And that's essentially what we have been doing here in Baltimore and what we will continue to do in Baltimore, right? Because I think back to, you know, right after the uprising, right, there was very little coverage of how all these different organizations and people came together to clean that community right back up because they realized life doesn't stop.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes,
they realized nothing stops, right? There were healing circles. Right. Sisters with their sage out in the streets getting it together.
That's right.
Right? Because we have to live here when it's all said and done.
Yes.
So we love Baltimore City. We love our communities. And even when there are instances that, like a panel said, makes it hard, we push through it and we do what needs to be done, right? So it's no question that things need to change in our community, that we need to stop the violence, whatever. But it's like we continue to push for it. What are you saying we should be doing? And that's what we're consistently trying to figure out.
What else should we be
doing? Exactly.
Because according to what we're hearing with our panelists, there's so much that's happening,
yes,
and people need to find a way to plug in, to use their unique talents to help to move this forward. I want to get to at least one or two more callers before we wrap up here. Ryan, you had a comment about the conversation. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello?
Yes, you're here. Ryan, what's your comment very quickly?
Okay, this is Brian with the William J. Watkins Senior Educational Institute.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment on one of the reply to one of the comments that one of your panelists made about K-12 education and the need to have these conversations in the classroom. Recently, we partnered with the Maryland State Department of Education and the Reginald F. Lewis Museum to put together a mini unit on the Baltimore uprising. We did a professional development workshop, and that mini unit is a part of the Maryland State Department of Education's African American History curriculum.
Excellent.
We also have upcoming a webinar in March on that. You can find out more information about that from either the Watkins Education website or the Maryland State Department of Education, as well as the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. But that information will be available shortly. We just got the approval for that. But it is very important to have these conversations with the youth in a K-12 environment, which is why we felt it was necessary to provide teachers with resources that they could use to have those conversations in a constructive manner. And that mini unit, the goal of it, and real briefly to wrap this up, the goal of it is to get students, get young people, to come up with constructive ideas and solutions to confront the problems that brought about the Baltimore uprising. So I just wanted to share that with you.
I really appreciate you sharing it with us. This notion that as we get ready to wrap the show, and the first half of the show anyway, and thinking about some of the things that we should go forward, Trippi, can you just give us one thing you think people need to really kind of focus their attention on in the short term before we hit the one-year anniversary of the Baltimore uprising?
Sure. I think this has been echoed by all the panelists. Really tap into your local communities. Hit Facebook, hit Twitter, hit wherever it is, your local community, your churches, your religious institutions, your whatever, and see what people are doing and moving. And if there isn't something that moves you or you feel that your talents are best led to, create it. There is nothing stopping in this moment from anyone creating what you want to see in the world, because we need all hands on deck. We need all energy on deck. And most importantly, we need all hearts on deck.
I like that. All energy, all hearts. We need all talents on deck. I just want to thank Dr. Bettina Love, Associate Professor at the University of Georgia. She's on her way to be a Harvard Fellow. Congratulations, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Dr. Treva Lindsay, Assistant Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at The Ohio State University. Thank you so much, Treva.
Thank you.
Good. Dr. Katrina McDonald, an Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University and board member of the Center for Africana Studies. Thank you. And we're so excited about Angela Davis coming.
Yes.
Yes. She's going to set Baltimore on fire in a good way, let me say. Lady Breon, I'm so glad you joined us. She's a spoken word artist and Baltimore's Grand Slam champion, resident poet for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and program manager for Do More Baltimore. Thank you so much.
She's fabulous.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a very brief break, but don't go away. Visit us online at steinershow.org. Or take a listen to some of our podcasts. We are here for you. Stay with us after the break for a new episode of Sound Bites, right here on your source for cool jazz and more.